Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Beverly Gage, a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, a story of America in its first age of terror. Her forthcoming book is G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Beverly Gage.
Thanks, Ian.
And the New York Times have an editorial on Tuesday, "The Democrats Stand Up to the Kochs." And in effect, the New York Times is celebrating the fact that the Democrats have started to show some backbone and are fighting back against the Kochs, who apparently are trying to buy this next election to ensure that Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky becomes the majority leader. He's now the minority leader. And it appears that, you know, they're taking the gloves off and going to take the fight. And, of course, it's no coincidence that the entire night last night on the floor of the U.S. Senate was devoted to arguments about climate change, often directed at the Koch brothers, who, of course, fund climate change denial. So how do you see this battle working out?
Well, I think it's a little hard to say quite yet how it's going to work out. I think it is remarkable that the Democrats are beginning to mount this challenge. And as a historian, it really does make me think of what things looked like 100 years ago, a little more than that, back in the Gilded Age, when in fact kind of business control, particularly of state legislatures, but of the federal electoral process, inspired a huge wave of social protest and actually a lot of the first efforts at campaign finance reform, some of which we still have today and some of which have been scaled back over time. So I'm not sure how much this can happen from Washington alone, but the Democrats in Washington really responding to kind of grassroots pressure, that combination of things, I think, could make a pretty big change.
But you have written about comparing the current Gilded Age to the previous Gilded Age and have made the argument in Slate magazine in an interview and also in an article, Radical Solutions to Economic Inequality, that in effect the plutocrats of today are getting off lightly compared to what happened back then.
They are. So that was my optimistic assessment, that maybe something really will come out of this latest round of protest. But I have to say, as a historian, what's been really striking about this economic crisis is, compared to almost any other moment of substantive economic crisis in the past, the people really have been very, very quiet. So if you go back to the late 19th century, you had labor battles. You had, in fact, members of what then would have been described as plutocrats. Today, we might say the 1%, right? People were actually living in fear of a genuine revolution, of their lives being endangered. And the book that I wrote was about a bombing on Wall Street in 1920. And there were a lot of these sorts of events. So I'm not sure we want to go back to that. But compared to that moment, compared to the 1930s, even compared to the 1970s, it's been pretty striking how little protest there's actually been in response to both inequality and the economic crisis in particular.
Well, of course, there has been some protest from some plutocrats, some hedge fund managers in Silicon Valley,
right,
complaining about it being like Kristallnacht, you know.
Right. Yes, there have been, particularly in recent months, some rather over-the-top statements about the embattled 1% and how they are under siege in ways that evoke some of the darkest periods of human history. And this is a historian, I can assure them, actually, that they should stop worrying, because for better or worse, this is not actually the case right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Beverly Gage, who's a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, a story of America in its first age of terror. Her forthcoming book is G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. So back in the original Gilded Age, where William Jennings Bryan ran against McKinley, I believe outspending the Democrat something like 200-1, but the Democrat, of course, is famous in the Scopes trial for defending creationism. he was able to put together a coalition of rural and urban poor united around a kind of religious left, if you will. And, of course, now we're in the era of the religious right, and it makes one wonder at what point do you think in this current revival of the arguments over wealth and income inequality, whether or not there will be a moral and religious component emerging?
Yeah, I do think William Jennings Bryan is one of these very interesting figures to think about. So the election that you mentioned, the 1896 election in which William Jennings Bryan ran against McKinley, and really was one of these famous watershed elections, both because it was really the first major election in which, again, we can use the language of the late 19th century, plutocrats bought the election, but in which figures like J.P. Morgan, figures from Wall Street, really funneled their money to McKinley and vastly outspent William Jennings Bryan. So it's an interesting moment from that perspective, but it's interesting as well because William Jennings Bryan at that point, though I think today he is more famous for the Scopes trial, at that point he was sort of the standard bearer of populism. And what populism was in the late 19th century was, as you said, a kind of interracial class movement of primarily farmers, but other people as well, the urban working class to some degree anyway. And it put a lot of pressure on, and then it kind of failed as a movement. And so I think one of the questions that's sort of up for debate today is whether populism, this kind of grassroots anger directed at people in power, is primarily going to be coming from the right, something like the Tea Party, or if there's still space in American politics for these kind of genuine grassroots movements from the left. Occupy Wall Street was one example, but it kind of flared up and disappeared. And so I think that's one of the big open questions of our moment.
Well, the other question I would have, since I'm a member of the press, Beverly Gage, is that the Gilded Age, of course, ended with the Progressive Era, led by the accidental president, Teddy Roosevelt. They put him on the ticket, I guess, to balance the plutocrat. And then, of course, the plutocrat McKinley was shot shortly after his inauguration, I think. But one of the interesting aspects of the Progressive Era was the extent to which the press, particularly figures like Mark Twain and Ida Tarbell, were able to expose the malfeasance of the plutocrats and get all this stuff in print. That it led, of course, to breaking up, you know, the antitrust movement that broke up Standard Oil.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people who are looking kind of hopefully at American politics and thinking that we're actually due up for a new progressive era. I mean, certainly someone like Bill de Blasio is saying that in New York, or Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian, that's really what her new book is all about, The Rise of Muckraking, The Rise of Progressivism. And there's certainly a lot of room for it at this point. I mean, I do think the progressive era, one of the things that's notable about it is that you've got really sweeping changes in a lot of ways in American life. It actually, in the end, didn't make a big difference in terms of inequality. So the peak of inequality in the United States was actually the 1920s, and it was the Depression and the reforms of the 1930s, which came slightly later, that were one of the few moments when inequality actually shrank. So are we due up for a new progressive era? I think a lot of people are wondering if that might be coming, but we might want to think about whether the strategies of the progressive era were really the strategies that we want today.
Well, yesterday, Beverly Gage, I was speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders about the all-nighter that they're about to pull in the Senate and the possibility that he may run for president. And we talked about the historical record that we're discussing now of the ebbs and flows between the progressive eras and the regressive eras, if you like. And the conclusion was, of course, that this didn't happen by some, you know, divine logic. This happened because of leadership. And, of course, the point he was making was that leadership is extremely absent today, although, as we're discussing here, according to the New York Times editorial on Tuesday, there is an indication that this Senate, the Democrats, may be standing up to the Koch brothers. But What's your sense then of the leadership vacuum? We talked about the press vacuum, and as much as we don't have muckrakers like Ida Tarbell, at least none that have certainly exposed the Koch brothers. But on the other point, we don't have FDR, we don't have Teddy Roosevelt. What's your sense of the political deficit?
Yeah, obviously figures like Teddy Roosevelt, like even Woodrow Wilson, and certainly Franklin Roosevelt, presidents are pretty important in this story. But I think it's also worth keeping in mind that all of them were responding as well to real pressure from below. So you look at a figure like Teddy Roosevelt, he sort of understands himself as a person who stands between the kind of threat of some larger working class revolution. This is, you know, before the Bolshevik Revolution. This is sort of the heyday of socialist utopianism. And he understood himself both to be kind of standing against that and bringing these reforms into an American system, but also standing against kind of plutocratic control, again, as he would have said. So I think presidents are obviously critically important. Leadership from Washington is critically important. But if you look at history, at either of the Roosevelts, certainly, they're really responding to pressure from below. And I think that it's very hard to lead when you don't have an organized social movement pushing you to really do this. This is something Franklin Roosevelt always liked to tell people is, I want to do this thing that you want me to do, whether it's labor legislation, or securities regulation. Now go out there and make me do it. And so I think it's a complicated equation. I think it can't only come from Washington.
Well, just in closing then, Beverly Gage, some of the most trenchant critics of the current wealth and income inequality have been some of the billionaires. Bill Gates' father once said you can't sail two yachts at the same time. Warren Buffett has said we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy. It's odd that only from the extremely wealthy have we heard a lot of, leading this critique, if you will. Do you think that since the last Gilded Age, in the age of communications, et cetera, have the American people been sort of lulled into a kind of stupor, accepting? We have celebrity culture that worships wealth and fame. It seems as though we're a much more passive society than we were, particularly back when you wrote about the day Wall Street exploded.
I do think that there's a certain amount of truth to that critique, although I also think social protest and kind of what we see of social protest has also just changed in form to some degree. But I also think that actually even figures like Warren Buffett are continuing a kind of self-critique that came about in the Gilded Age, the first Gilded Age. So if you look at figures like Andrew Carnegie, if you look even to a certain degree at someone like John D. Rockefeller, though he's, I think, in many people's minds, really the kind of ultimate plutocrat of the Gilded Age, they actually had certain critiques of wealth and certain critiques of concentrations of wealth. A lot of that ended up being channeled through philanthropy, which, again, is something that you see happening among the 1% today. But I think that understanding that, in fact, the wealthy bear a certain burden for thinking through these questions, as well as the people in the other 99%, I think that, too, really is a legacy of the first Gilded Age.
Well, Beverly Gage, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Well, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Beverly Gage, who's a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, A Story of America and Its First Age of Terror. Her forthcoming book is G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Me.
the headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.